You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money you spend. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moment.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Ash Carter. Beginning as a physicist charged with safeguarding America from Soviet nuclear threats, Ash Carter served in numerous jobs at the Department of Defense under presidents of both parties, most recently as Secretary of Defense under President Obama. He is currently the director of Harvard Kennedy School's Belfar Center for Science and International Affairs, where he leads the Technology and Public Purpose Project. He also is an Innovation Fellow and Corporation Member at MIT. A native of Philadelphia, he and his wife Stephanie have two grown children. He has written a new book. It's called Inside the Five Sided Box, Lesson from a Lifetime of Leadership in the Pentagon. Secretary Carter, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kelly. Good to be here.
A few years ago, one of our longtime facilitators at Second City, his name is Mark Sutton, had just come back from leading an innovation workshop, and he told me that he had a story from an interaction he had with one of the attendees of the workshop. So he led this group through an exercise that we call 60-30-10, and that's where we have the individuals in the workshop tell us a story in 60 seconds, then we have them tell us the same story in 30 seconds, and finally, they tell the story in 10 seconds. So basically, we're trying to tune your communication muscles. Sometimes you need to get to the point more quickly, and sometimes you have more time. Your wife, Stephanie, was in the workshop, and she recounted that that was a very similar dynamic when you go in to talk to the president.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, great. You got a chance to meet Steph. Well, she's the better half. And I think she told me about this.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you actually talk about this in the book, that when you are, you know, in the Oval Office, you have to be sort of prepared to communicate in a different way depending on the time.
Yeah, I mean, you never know. You walk in there, and sometimes the president would. I typically did these in the late afternoon. These are one-on-one meetings at the Oval Office, and he would when it the last thing he had to do in the day, and so he was going upstairs to have dinner with his family afterwards, and. Something could intervene. He could be in a hurry. He could be impatient. He could be grouchy. But most of the time, he was very interested. And, of course, my job, in a sense, was to get as much information across to him as quickly as I could. I was lucky in every president I ever dealt with. And I have not dealt with the current president.
Which but, you would not be so lucky.
I've met him a few. Well, he doesn't seem to be an information absorber.
No.
The way most of his predecessors were. Certainly Barack Obama and those who came before him, you could be complicated, and by the time they got to their second term, they had accumulated a lot of knowledge. So you might be surprised at what a president in his second term, remember the last three of them have had two terms.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I knew President Obama, including in his very last year, and the guy had been on the job for a long time. So if you mentioned some small Syrian city, you didn't have to say that's a small Syrian city.
Hmm.
He knew exactly what you were talking about, and that sort of shaved things off a little bit.
And I want to get to the presidents in a moment. But I think it's a and you obviously do this on purpose in terms of where you start the book. I don't think most of us understand the scope and the vastness of the DOD. And you lay out in very stark terms what that means in terms of as an employer, as a money spend. Mm-hmm. Give us some sense for our audience about what you're dealing with and what we're dealing with.
Largest employer in the country, larger than Amazon and FedEx and McDonald's and Target and GE combined. But we R&D larger than Apple, Google, and Microsoft combined. Real estate about the size of the state of Pennsylvania. If you take all our buildings, our bases and posts, about the size of the state of Pennsylvania. Half of the federal government, half of the federal budget. I used to remind the president and his staff that when I was with them, I was helping him make policy. But that was a small part of my job. I knew it was important, but I also ran half the federal government for him. So it is the largest enterprise on earth and employs about 3 million people directly, and then indirectly, because it's so much money, $750 billion, most of which we spend on contractors, right? That's mm-hmm. who does the government's job. So those are all basically employed by us as well. So all together, you get up around 7-8 million people, and then their families and dependents and so forth. So you're responsible for a substantial chunk of the American populace simply in terms of its day-to-day welfare. And obviously, you're responsible for the safety of the whole thing.
And so many RFPs. I was like, yes. This is crazy.
Yeah, we have 10,000 contracting officers who negotiate and sign those contracts. Unloading $750 billion a year on a whole variety of things. I mean, it's from super secret airplanes to mowing the lawn at bases to building. I tell the story in the book of the big push in 2009, 2010 in Afghanistan, and I was the undersecretary then, not the number one, but the number three, the guy who actually spends all the money and does this stuff on a day-to-day basis for the secretary, and I built 258 bases in Afghanistan that summer. Think of contracting for that. Who do you contract with to build a base in Afghanistan? There's not even, at that time, there wasn't even a single concrete factory in the entire country.
So you literally had to bring in concrete.
Yeah, from Pakistan. So then you have to find truckers. Whom can you trust? And you can't let them just drive in your base because maybe somebody will load a bomb on board. So you have to have a base outside of the base where they sit for a day and you check them out and you check out the driver. And everything turns into a big project when you're operating anywhere, but particularly when you're operating in a war zone.
So there's a bunch of really wonderful stories in the book. And one of them that I loved the drama of, and there's some comedy there too, was around the bidding process for the Air Force aerial refueling tanker. Can you kind of take us through how that played out?
Yeah, so this is the largest aircraft contract in history. It is to replace the huge fleet of tanker aircraft that the Air Force has. And what are they? They seem like a fairly unremarkable kind of thing. What you do is you take an ordinary airliner, more or less, you rip all the seats out, and you put a big bladder in that you fill up with fuel. And then you fly around and act as a gas station for other airplanes. And you either stick a probe out the back your back end, and another airplane comes up behind. By the way, this is very... a very interesting dance to watch. Two huge aircraft at 30,000 feet that are only within 4 or 5 feet of each other, flying in formation, while a little proboscis comes out of one and pokes in a hole in the other and pumps gas in. And so we have hundreds of these. And right now they're based on an old airliner that's 40, 50 years old, and we have to replace the whole fleet. So we it's time to have a competition for it. Now, before I came into office, because this thing was so big, it attracts a lot of attention, it attracts a lot of politics, right? Uh-huh. And in this case, it there had been three spectacular failures of DOD to do this right, including some people ending up in jail. And my job, when I came in, Bob Gates was the Secretary of Defense, and I was his weapons buyer. And he said, I'm going to give this job to you. And my job was to do a fair competition for this task that met the warfighter's need and that the taxpayer could be proud of in the face of all this politics and all this craziness that goes with a big chunk of money. So you say to yourself, well, okay, who's going to bid on this thing? Well, the obvious ones are going to bid are Boeing mm-hmm. and Airbus, a nominally American company and a nominally European company. Now, how can any foreign company possibly win a bid in the United States? In general, we are rather protectionist with our taxpayer money. Not always, and there are some exceptions to that. But the fact of the matter is that Airbus could bid because most of these airplanes aren't European or American at all. Mm-hmm. Every piece of it is made in a different country. So the actual American content of a Boeing aircraft and the American content of an Airbus aircraft are not all that different. So we could have them bid against each other. And so we set the whole thing off, and there's a huge amount of politics involved, radio ads, if you're commuting in Washington. And this is ridiculous, of course, because that is not how, when we're behaving properly, which we mostly do, and certainly I was, no politics, no intervention is going to have anything to do with it. We run a very professional, fair acquisition process. But I have to show that it's fair. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it'll be tainted in the public eye, and there'll be hearings in Congress and so forth. So, as you indicate, the first step is I have to put an RFP out there. Mm-hmm. An RFP is just a way of saying, here's what I want. And in order to discipline the thing, I wrote that extremely carefully, and then I showed it to both bidders and said, you're welcome to make inputs into here, but you tell me now mm-hmm. if you think in any way this advantages the competition unfairly against you in some way that isn't based on merit or demerit. And I took it up to Capitol Hill, and I said, you all look at this, because in a while, I'm going to use this to pick a winner. There's going to be a winner, and there's going to be a loser here. And some of you will be happy, because your constituents will be happy, because that pieces for that airplane are made in your state or your district, and maybe they'll be unhappy. But I want you to know now what you're getting into, and I briefed it to them. And then the normal way I proceed at that point is to get the bidders to make their bids. I would appoint some of our most senior, most distinguished, most experienced acquisition officers, generals and admirals, to sit as a secret committee. That is, I wouldn't identify their names publicly, because if I did, people would lobby them.
Right.
Put them in a secret location and say, you guys examine the bids and come to me and tell me who won. And my job is to shield you from the politics. Hmm. You get the Air Force the best aerial refueling tanker. And fortunately, I had a boss and a boss's boss at that time, Bob Gates, Secretary of Defense. Barack Obama was the President of the United States, and they wanted it that way, too. Mm-hmm. I'm very glad to say, because otherwise I would have had a problem, because mm-hmm. my conscience tells me to do things on the up and up. I wouldn't have liked it if I were interfered with, but I wasn't. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean Congress and the press and everybody else wasn't interfering. So it's really important that things be squeaky clean. So the first thing that happens, as I tell from the book, is one day the Boeing bids come in and the Airbus bids come in, and what we do next is send back a note to each of the bidders that asks them for clarification of certain parts of their bids. There's a certain amount of back and forth. Uh-huh. And the clerk in the mailroom at the Air Force Base in Ohio, where this was done, puts the Boeing bid information in the Airbus envelope and the Airbus information in the Boeing envelope and sends them off. Now you've poisoned the whole thing, yeah. Potentially, mm-hmm. because they're privy to one another's bids, which they're not supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And so it was too late to recall them, and we had to quickly go to each location, find whoever had seen those bids, which turned out to be very few people, mm-hmm. remove them entirely from their company's competition. We had our cyber experts go in and make sure that only the people who confessed to having looked at the information had actually seen the information, mm-hmm. and they were mostly just clerical people.
Yep.
So we got through that hurdle. Then along comes a Ukrainian company.
Oh, the Ukrainians.
The Ukrainians, the former Soviet Union's yep. big airplane builder. Mm-hmm. And they say, hey, can we bid? Now, for many reasons, this is ridiculous. But I'm trying to preserve the reputation of this competition as free, fair, and open. So I say, okay, I guess you can. I'll give you a few weeks and you prepare a bid. But it's awkward. Mm-hmm. And the day comes when the bids are due at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. And they're due at noon. And with plenty of time to go, Boeing and Airbus deliver their bids. And the minutes go by, and no bid from the Ukrainians. What had happened was the Ukrainians were, and one of the many reasons why their bidding was so sketchy was they did everything through some lawyer. Hmm. And they submitted their bid in the following form. They printed it out on a printer rather than sending a disk or anything. They printed it out on a printer. They put it in a Whitman's chocolates box, handed it to a taxi driver in uh-huh. downtown Dayton uh-huh. who had only been in the United States for about 3 weeks mm-hmm. and told him to deliver it to an Air Force base. Well, you can't get in an Air Force base if you're a taxi driver.
Right.
So he pulls up to the gate and he says, I'm here to deliver a bid. And it took quite some time for it to get sorted out. But eventually he's allowed to drive in and deliver his bid. But he missed the deadline.
Yeah.
And so fortunately we were able to, on that basis, because that's a very, very, very firm rule, eliminate the Ukrainians and go on. And now you might ask, who won? Who won this largest ever contract award in American history? Who won it? Well, it actually turned out to be Boeing. Mm-hmm. I learned that from the source selection committee a few days before. I asked Bob Gates if he wanted to know who won, and he said, no, don't tell me, because then when I go to the White House and anybody asks me, I can say I genuinely don't know, mm-hmm. which is, if you think about that, that's a very respectable
right.
position for your boss to take, protecting you as you protect the integrity of something. And then one day came, and just as the markets were closing on a Thursday afternoon, I stepped to the podium in the Pentagon newsroom after calling the key members of Congress that would be affected and telling them who won, went out and announced. And you know what happened? It was never protested. Hmm. All the times that competition blew up before then. And it told me what I think the taxpayer ought to know, which is that we actually can and almost always do a competent job of spending what is a huge amount of money. It's hard work, but it's a very important thing to do. But it's done fairly and honestly, despite the constant efforts of the political system
to interfere. And this is because, and you write in the book about there's value to transparency, and there are no shortcuts. And every time you sort of play in that arena, the problems do arise.
Yeah, and you can't. You have to protect your own people,
mm-hmm.
and it, tell them, I expect you to do the right thing. If you don't, you'll be fired. But if you do the right thing and that is politically unpopular, I will defend you. And that is a very important part of leadership in the public sector. Hmm. And in the acquisition area, what it really meant is when a member of Congress would start bullying a general somewhere who had ran a base and therefore spent money in their area, mm-hmm. or was doing a contract award there, you had to swoop in and protect that officer. Let me give you an example. I had a two-star Air Force officer whom I put in charge of buying services for the Air Force. You might think, you think of us buying stuff as the Pentagon, you think of us buying ships and tanks and planes mm-hmm. and satellites and stuff like that, but actually half of the money we spend is for services, not for goods. Mm-hmm. And I told you what the process was for buying airplanes. The process is a little bit different when it comes to buying services, as you know, mm-hmm. because you buy services. We all do. We sure. get something, maybe if you have a house to mow our lawn, we're buying services to somebody to come be a plumber. That's different from buying your appliance mm-hmm. or buying your house. So we all know that it takes a different little skill set to do those. If you're playing in the very, very big league of $750 billion a year, you have to train people differently. So I asked her to help the Air Force be better at buying services as opposed to goods. And she went about doing that. And obviously she rocked some boats mm-hmm. in doing that, which is what I expect her to do. So one day I get a call from a congressman. I'm the number three at the time. This congressman from Florida calls. And he has been giving her a hard time over a contract that somebody in his district lost, that she had recompeted is a way of improving the Air Force's performance, as she was supposed to do, and he didn't like it. So he was calling me, her boss's boss's boss, to complain and try to twist my arm. So he tells me the story of why this was difficult for him and his constituent, and I told him, Congressman, I'm afraid that General Masiello, her name was, that General Masiello is doing exactly what I asked her to do. And he harumphed, and we hung up, mm-hmm. except that I did something that probably everybody listening to this has done, you've surely done, Kelly, mm-hmm. which is when you have one of these phones that's on speaker,
yeah,
and it's on a cradle, yeah. and you hang it up, it doesn't hang up.
It doesn't hang up.
So I hung up the phone, turned to my staff, and said, make sure he doesn't bully her.
Mm.
He heard it.
Yeah.
So a minute later, this guy sends me a letter. In fact, didn't send it, he faxed it, believe it or not. So he faxes me an angry letter and saying he's going to raise a big fuss over this remark. And I'm thinking, okay, he's going to call up a reporter now, and there'll be a big brouhaha. So I asked my staff, just dial him up. And I dialed him up, and I said, Congressman, I'm sorry you heard what I said, but I'm not sorry I said it.
Yeah.
And long pause, and then he said, well, okay, Mr. Secretary, and I never heard from it again.
Hmm.
But there's an example of a public official, and I'm not trying to make myself out to be unique. People do this. People who are good public servants do this every day. They protect their subordinates from political bullying when they're trying in the accomplishment of a professional task. In this case, it's buying stuff. But the same thing was true when we were planning operations, conducting wars, I'm hiring and firing people. These are all consequential decisions. And if you want to have the military that's the best in the world, which ours is, you can't play politics with that. How do you play politics in a government that is a How do you not play politics in a government that's a democracy? Well, you count upon the senior leadership, like myself, who are politically appointed and are confirmed by the Senate. We're supposed to take the heat. That's part of the leadership. And I took that very seriously. And sometimes it doesn't win you the popularity contest, but it does with the people who work for you. And they say, okay, you know, this is a guy who sticks up for me. If I do the right thing, I'm going to do the right thing. And then suddenly you have a whole lot of people who are doing their job on the public's behalf to the best of their ability. And that's why I hate to see these people disparaged in Washington, these professionals these days.
Yeah.
This is to the detriment of our own government. Government's important. It's not a foreign, it's not like some friendly alien planet. Government is not a thing apart from us. Government is how we collectively do something that needs to be done, but that nobody has the individual incentive to do, like defend the country, build roads, run schools. And if you have to respect and support at some level the people who are doing this on our behalf. And this belittling of government I see everywhere these days is really bothersome to me.
Yeah, and I don't think the irony is lost on anyone. You know, we're recording this during the impeachment hearings, and there is a lot of people not protecting their people. There are some people stepping forward, and you write in the book, quote, "We can't afford to lose our faith in truth as our essential compass." And right now, it really feels like that's in danger.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that's something I used to associate, you know, with Vladimir Putin, whom I met way back in the 90s. The North Koreans, which I've had 25 years of, and now my own society is telling itself things that aren't true.
Yeah.
And fudging the difference between true and false, and saying that somebody else's reporting is false news or fake news. These are tricks that I associated with the countries that I used to be building war plans against.
Right.
And now I hope only temporarily I'm seeing some of it in my own country.
Yeah, yeah. There's an interesting thread throughout the book, which does tie to our work, and it comes across in a few different ways, and it's the importance of practice. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about this in a work context, that as we become adults and we move into positions of leadership, really we stop practicing our craft. And that is not true of other kinds of peak performers, whether they be musicians and artists or sports officials. But in the case of the military, you have these exercises and military games, and you even have a moment where you talk to your son who's going to be speaking before Congress, and you tell him to be prepared to improvise during the hearing. So talk to us about that importance, because this is really gets at, you know, collaborative skills and tackling complexity, which really can't be achieved without some form of practice.
Well, there's for the military, if you think about it, is very good at practice because it is an institution that mostly doesn't do what it's for. Mostly for war, and mostly we're not at war.
If you're
a car maker, you're mostly making cars, and so you're mostly doing every day what you do. And the distinction between practice and doing isn't there. But for the rest of life, for most of us, and for the rest of us in life, is mostly like the military. That is, we will only have one opportunity to stand up in front of the camera and give a press conference, one opportunity to sit before Congress. And one of the points I made in the book, and I try to tell people how to do it, was I was never too proud to practice. You may say, well, come on, Carter, you've been doing this for 37 years. How many hearings have you been to? But every hearing I would practice and practice and practice beforehand, because I wanted to do an excellent performance, both because I wanted to make a good showing for the department and do the right thing, but also those are environments in which if you fail, you fail spectacularly. You make a fool of yourself. And what congressmen are really good at is helping, is making a foolish remark look even more foolish.
Mm-hmm.
So I would practice very hard before all those things for hours and hours and hours. Institutionally, you know, before we sent a brigade to Afghanistan, we would build little villages in the desert that looked just like Afghan villages, and they would spend day after day. We would have actors in the villages acting the part of Afghan villagers, and bad guys would be mixed in with the villagers, and our soldiers would have to learn what they were going to have to do, which is distinguish enemy from population. And so we happen to be an institution that's very good at practice. Mm-hmm. But I also, and it's necessary in warfare, but I think in most enterprises, it's good before you ask your enterprise or your to do something new or to do something of great consequence. It always helps to practice. It helps their performance, and it helps everybody gain more confidence in what they're going to do. Individually, you should never be too proud. Mm-hmm. However long you've been, even if you're at the very top, and of course you're at the very top, I'm Secretary of Defense, who am I going to practice with?
Right.
I'm going to have to practice by definition with my subordinates, mm-hmm. because everybody's subordinate to me.
Yep.
And so now and of course you're going to stumble, you're going to say, well, no, I don't want to say it that way. And you have to be willing to expose yourself a little bit to your subordinates, and let them, and you have to let them attack you and question you and say, wait a minute, Mr. Secretary, that argument doesn't make any sense. In other words, do all the things that a reporter will do or a member of Congress will do, and find the weaknesses in whatever you're saying or the vulnerabilities in your point of view or your strategy, and you have to do that in front of them. But I in the book, I openly recommend it to people. I recommended it to my son.
Yeah.
He was going to do his first hearing before the Congress, and that was one of the pieces of advice I gave him. By the way, in the book, the book is an executive guide to the Pentagon. It's kind mm-hmm. of a how-to. If you took aside a future Secretary of Defense and said, hey, listen, let me give you some tips. I've been doing this a long time, and maybe you read this, you'll have a little tradecraft under your belt before you mm-hmm. go to the job. And of course, not everybody's going to be Secretary of Defense, so I really wrote it for anybody who is curious about how to prepare themselves for a senior leadership job, which is most people, or alternatively, just curious about the Pentagon, never been inside the place before, always wondered what the largest enterprise on Earth was like. What do they do inside that funny building that I see as I fly in the National Airport mm-hmm. if I go to Washington? I like being taken to a place, Kelly, where I've never been.
Right.
And thinking about reading books about places I've never been or things I've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And most people will never be Secretary of Defense, but even many people who've been in the Washington or the Defense Department, it turns out I was there so long in so many different roles that I'm unique among Secretaries of Defense of having done every piece of the whole thing, from
right.
war to spending money to hiring and firing and so forth. And I thought it was useful to bring all that experience together.
Yeah, there's almost a Rashomon quality to it. So I know we got to let you go, but I do want to see if I can get you to close out the podcast as all our guests do, where we ask our guest for a yes and story. So the idea here is most of us have a default setting where we say no or we do nothing. But so there's some times in our lives where we don't stop at yes, we say yes and. We affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. I think you have a million of these stories. I'll just ask you for one.
Well, the most important ones were always with the President of the United States.
Yeah.
And your job, if you work for a president, and remember, this guy's very busy, he's under a lot of pressure, you're trying to help him. And so if he would ask for something, I would try not to say no,
mm-hmm.
but always to answer with a yes and.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, to try to add to his stock of either options or knowledge. So if I were going to disagree with President Obama, and he would go along with this, but my usual way of prefacing that would be to say, Mr. President, I hear where you want to go, but let me suggest another place you want to go. or, because it's very important to tell somebody if you're going to disagree with them that you've heard what they had to say. That's the yes part.
Yep.
And if your disagreement with the president was softer and you did know where he was wanted to go and you agreed with it, but you had a different path, you would say, Mr. President, let me give you another way to get where you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
That's a positive way of essentially disagreeing. And even with the president of the United States, they're human beings too. And it goes down a lot smoother and allows the ears to open up and gives you a better hearing and also establishes you as somebody who's really trying to help him.
Yep.
If you start with no only, you're another constraint, another source of opposition, another person who's setting up barriers. These people live with that the whole day. And so I always tried to be somebody who took weight off of the president's shoulders. And my best subordinates, including the best appointment I ever, the best decision I ever made, was to recommend to the president that he choose Joe Dunford as my chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Joe was my best partner because Joe was a yes and, rather no and person. He could disagree with you, but he took you somewhere.
Yeah.
He added to your forward progress. So I think that's a very effective tactic.
Yep.
If you're going to be a subordinate, and most of us are going to be a subordinate to somebody, and even the president feels pretty subordinate to all the rest of us.
Yeah, that's very true. The book is called Inside the Five-Sided Box, Lessons from a Lifetime of Leadership in the Pentagon. Secretary Ash Carter, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. Really good to be here.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
one survives.